from the University of Victoria. Julio got his PhD in 1990 at the University of Cordoba in Argentina. He also received his undergraduate degree from the same institution. He was a pre-doc, I guess, at CFA at that time. And then in 1991, he went to Cambridge, and after that, he was a postdoc at Durham and a postdoc at Arizona, so a long list of prestigious places. And then in 98, he landed in Victoria, where he's been for the most part ever since, I guess, with a hiatus here and there. It's, you know, Julio is truly one of the leaders in studies of dark matter halos, and he and his colleagues have really essentially set the paradigm for how we think about galaxies and the formation of galaxies. So, and he's been, his research has taken a bit of a turn. He's gone from things on a very large scale to now zooming in and looking at halos in great detail on smaller scales. So, Julio's going to tell us about that today. Thanks, Julio.
Okay, thanks, Brian. Let me just set the stage here and see a few people who are not necessarily astronomers, so I'll spend just two transparencies just trying to give you the basic flavor. This is what, if you had a dark matter sensitive eyes, you'd see if you were to look at the Milky Way from a distance, for example. That is a dark matter simulation, and the idea here is that this program we started called the Aquarius program, and I think it's called the Aquarius program because we ran out of ideas as how we can name this in a sexy way. And that it is to do the highest resolution numerical simulations possible just for the dark matter problem. And that is not only because of the well-posed problem, we know the initial conditions, presumably for cold dark matter, and we can just follow it in the computer without almost no assumptions, but also because now, as I try to convince you, there are a bunch of interesting things we can still do and still unsolved in that problem. So, the idea is that we know the initial conditions, we can look at the microwave background properties, we can look at the large-scale structure properties, and from that we can infer, you know, what were the properties. We know more or less the expansion history of the universe, we know the initial conditions, and therefore we can just set, you know, a specified dark matter perturbation spectrum, and then it's just basically an n-body problem. So we just follow this in the computer, and this is one of the simulations from this consortium that I'm part of called the Virgo Consortium. And mostly are scientists in Germany and in England, and a bunch of us, you know, in Canada and the US and elsewhere. This is one of the papers that we wrote a few years ago now about the Millennium Simulation. This was, at the time, was the largest simulation ever done of a cosmologically representative piece of the universe. This is what the universe looks like then today on a gigaparsec scale. And if you zoom in to this object over here, you can see how it's made up. This is one of the largest objects in this simulation. It's a big galaxy cluster, and there's even another zoomed-in version of it. So what this simulation, for example, to give you an idea of the scale, this is basically a couple radius, and it has about 10 billion particles. And what I'd like to take you now is the different simulation, the one we just finished a few months ago, which basically the idea is to follow the formation of a single individual dark matter halo with comparable resolution. And that is basically the aims, the goals of the Aquarius project. So this is what the universe looks like at high redshift. If you now evolve, and I'll show you a little movie as to how the idea, how we would think the universe evolves. So it goes from that almost uniform, barely perturbed distribution of matter. Gravitational stability takes over as the universe expands, and you start forming, you know, these aggregations of clumps of material that we call dark matter halos, and presumably are hosts of all the luminous objects on extragalactic scales that we form. And so this is basically where the paradigm within which we will be working. Just give another idea, give the idea of sort of more context. This is what the Milky Way, again, would look like if you were looking at it from far away. And to give you an idea of sense of scale, this is the size of the disk and the bulge of the Milky Way. This is what you observe. And we are somewhere here towards the edge of the disk. That's where the sun is. And you can see the object, dark matter halo, that presumably formed together with the Milky Way, of course, it extends to much, much further out. So if you want to have an idea, for example, how far out do you need to go to get to the regions where, you know, we consider the system more or less virialized, in the sense that the crossing time is closer, it's shorter than the edge of the universe, and therefore there's some, you know, hope that the region inside is in equilibrium, that is about, you know, 300 kiloparsecs. Compare that to 8 kiloparsecs, which is the distance from the sun to the center of the galaxy, and get an idea of scale. This is not, this is the current narrative, and it's sort of narrative compression, but I think it's a reasonably accurate one. So for these dark matter halos, you know, over the past several years, you know, these individual objects, that they were like the ones I was talking about, we've worked on them, you know, for the past about 10 years or so, perhaps even more. And there are a number of results that I think are pretty uncontroversial, which are fairly well established now. One of them is that the mass profiles of these objects are nearly universal. In other words, if you extend the center of any of these dark matter halos, and then you just plot how the density scales with the distance to that center, and you compare two different objects, for example, a small little halo, one here, for example, that tiny little one there, with this big one, or with an even bigger one, a galaxy cluster, for example, all those mass profiles are basically equivalent. It's just a scaling problem. If you scale things properly, then this mass profile of this small little object looks exactly the same as this one. And this is, you know, sort of the idea that these mass profiles are nearly universal. In other words, the shape of the mass profile, density profile, is independent of the mass. It turns out it's also independent of cosmology, independent of cosmological parameters, independent of zeroth order, or even of the power spectrum, provided that you form these things more or less hierarchically. And that was an interesting result, which still, you know, we haven't been able to explain from first principles, but it seems a recurrent one. The interesting thing that we found in the simulations is that these dark matter profiles are cuspy, in the sense that if you do two simulations where you improve your numerical resolution, and you monitor how the density near the center changes, the highest density you can resolve always goes up. And there does not seem to be any obvious constant density or, you know, characteristic density to which this dark matter is converging. And we believe that's just a reflection of the problem. The problem, the cold dark matter, you know, in the sense that, you know, in the extreme that has zero temperature to begin with, there is no restrictions in phase space, and therefore, you know, you can get to as high densities as you want in certain fraction of the system. And that is actually interesting for reasons that I'll get back to in a second. But I think you can see already from here is that these dark matter halos are clumpy. They're full of substructures. And that is because of this hierarchical way in which these things are put together. A big object is made out of smaller objects that collapse early, and they just get assembled one after the other. Although during the assembly process, most of the mass is mixed into a uniform and monolithic structure, we call the halo, the cores, because they're so dense near the center, because there's this cusp near the center, the real, very, very small inner regions remain self-bound, and therefore just orbit in the potential of the main halo for, you know, long periods of time before tides eventually disrupt them completely. The other thing is that these halos are triaxial, so they're not actually spherical. And this has actually interesting implications for observational probes. And I'll try to just touch upon a couple of these things, and many of the things we're talking about, the things that will probably have made a bit more progress through this new series of simulations. Just to give an idea of what kind of outstanding issues we still have, you know, with this. So for example, what is the structure of the central cusp? You know, over the years, people have said, oh, you know, it's true the density keeps increasing as you increase your, you know, your numerical resolution for the simulation, but how does it increase? And that is important. For example, people have proposed that, for example, this density might actually diverge like r to the minus 1.5, okay, like r to the minus 3/2. And that's actually quite important because, for example, things that depend on the square of the density, like annihilation signal, if, you know, dark matter is a self-annihilating particle, scale like density square, if you scale as density square and the cusp goes like r to the minus 1.5, then this does not converge. Therefore, it means that most of the signal that will come from annihilation will actually come from a small little dot at the center of the halo. If the profile were not as steep, in the center but much shallower, say r to minus 1 or so, that is not true. The signal converges, and what you see in the sky is a whole region, extended region, from which most of the photons that are produced by the annihilation will come from. So this kind of, you know, qualitative differences are actually quite important. So it's important to establish the structure of the central cusp once and for all. I think we now have a very good evidence for which one of these ideas might be correct. The other thing that's interesting is, for example, understanding what is the structure of these substructures. As I mentioned, there are lots of little subhalos that live inside these other halos. There has been, you know, actually a revolution, you know, understanding of galaxies on the very, very small scales, on the faintest scales, over the past 5 or so years, with the discovery of, you know, dozens of small little satellites around the Milky Way. Those are presumably living inside this tiny little substructure halos that I was showing in that simulation, and therefore we can actually use the information we can gather from the dynamics of stars in these very faint satellites to see what are the properties of dark matter on these very, very densest scales. Okay, so unfortunately, because this, you know, the substructure is actually quite hard to follow and quite hard to resolve in the numerical simulations, it's been hard to predict what are the properties of these dark matter halos on these very small scales, especially because, you know, they're subject to strong tidal forces and they may have different histories. So it's important to establish really what is the structure of substructure to make direct contact with the constraints that might come from the observations of these very faint satellites. So the last thing I want to mention is just what is the phase space distribution of dark matter on a very, very small scale. So for example, if you were now to build a detector here for dark matter, for, you know, direct dark matter detection, what you'd like to see is basically collisions, or the effects of collisions between these dark matter particles and whatever it is in your detector. And to interpret those collisions and to isolate it from the background of other collisions they may have, you need to know something about what kind of signal you expect. Do you expect, for example, a signal that is, I mean, you expect, for example, the dark matter to go through the detector with more like Gaussian velocities? Do you expect to have a directionality, for example, that is preferred? How many do you expect to have per unit kinetic energy, for example? All those things, if you can predict them, can actually be quite useful. Of course, we're talking about things that are on the scales of, you know, much smaller than the Earth, and the simulations are on the scales of parsecs. So, as you can see, both for these annihilation signals and also for these direct detection predictions, you will involve, you know, a huge extrapolation, and that needs to be borne in mind. So, although simulations don't resolve these issues to that level, and probably won't for a long, long time, they do give us some ways of educating our guesses and informing our extrapolations in order to make them compelling. I'll show you this Aquarius program. This simulation, basically, we took 6 different halos chosen at random from a much larger simulation, then they were resimulated. And one of the interesting things that we did is we took exactly the same 6 halos and we simulated them many times, increasing systematically the numerical resolution. And because, you know, because we don't know the answer to this problem, that is really almost the only, beyond, you know, checking for the obvious things about numerical accuracy and convergence, this is really the only way we know to check that our results are at least, you know, reproducible. So for now, I'll give you an idea here. This is the numerical resolution of 1 series of them. These are 5 of them. Actually, we have many more. Low resolutions are easier to do, so I just listed 5 of them, where you go, basically change the number of particles in the system. So the first one we did had about 1 million particles, 6 million, 50 million, 200 million, and 1.5 billion. So this one has a mass per particle of order 10 to the 3 solar masses. That is basically the best that one can do now. To give you an idea how much this costs in terms of computing power, we actually exhausted our allocation of more than 4 million CPU hours at the Leibniz Rechenzentrum in Garching in Munich to do only 1 part of this problem. Yes. This is the same halo. We did 6 of them. Okay, so I'm just showing you the numbers for one of them. They're all comparable. They're just all comparable resolutions. But I have 6 of them, so I can actually compare also what is the likely halo-to-halo scatter, which is also important. So just to give you an idea where these halos come from, this is one of them. You know, one of the halos is here, one little dot over here. Another halo actually was this one here. Another one was there, etc. So they're chosen just at random from a list of halos that we compiled, you know, without any other condition. The only condition we put was that there was no other much bigger halo very, very close to it, just to, you know, basically we're excluding things that are, for example, excluding halos that are galaxies that might be very, very close to the galaxy cluster. The idea is that, you know, we try to study the systems in isolation rather than study the systems as they may have been perturbed by this cluster. These are the pictures of them. You know, this is the level 2 resolution. We only have actually one at this level 1 resolution with 1.5 billion. Then we have all 6 of them at about 200 million particles. So this is what they look like at 200 million particles. And what you should see is that they actually look very much alike. They all have lots of, you know, substructures and similar, you know, degrees of asphericity. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
It looks like filaments coming out of the central halo. This is a two-dimensional section, two-dimensional slice of the simulation, presumably. Are these filaments actually sections of two-dimensional sheets?
Some of them are and some of them not. I mean, it's actually a very complicated topology of two and three and two and one-dimensional filaments. So basically what...
Yes. Happen to have cuts in the right angle.
What the best on scales are slightly nonlinear, like this scale, and the bigger scale, like this scale, for example. The mass, you may think of it as collections of hands, like, you know, sort of filaments, if you want, you know, one-dimensional objects, you know, kind of living in two-dimensional. On the hand, it's kind of can be curved as well, so it can be hands like this. So that's sort of the topology that you may think of. I mean, it's a crude, and people. Some people do this for a living, right? They actually come up with numbers to quantify the topology of what comes out of basically a random or a Poisson distribution of points that gets, you know, amplified by gravity. And actually, it turns out you can actually predict, you know, a lot of the numbers of this topology to good accuracy. But yes, these are material things. Actually, the material actually flows down these filaments and accretes into these scales. And that's why these scales are something I didn't remark on, but that's why scales are so prolate. You can actually, if you extrapolate them up and down, you can see they're part of a long filament. I mean, not all of them, and there's a fair amount of diversity in it. Forgot to say, if you have any other questions, no matter what basic, just stop me and I'll try to answer them. So this is what they look like. And now we'll talk about, I'll show you a quick movie about, you know, how one of these forms. Actually, this is not the largest simulation one. It's actually the level 2 one. And the reason is that it's actually impossible to store enough outputs of this to make a good movie. Actually, just loading into a fast workstation, is there a way to dim a little lights? Just for the movie. So it's a lot better, yeah. So I'll start again. You can see, I mean, of course, the camera is rotating around, so it can actually give you an idea of three dimensions. And this is what you have to work with. So this is, for example, this is what the Milky Way looked. Almost all this matter will end up in the same object. This is what the Milky Way looked, you know, at redshift of 25 or 30. You see there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tiny little halos where, you know, for example, the earliest stars that formed in the Milky Way could have been formed. And all of this matter eventually will flow, you know, flows down these filaments, congregates into clumps, and these clumps eventually, you know, get caught into larger scale filaments and flow in and all converge into a single object. And you can see there are many, many branches with its filaments, and the topology is quite complicated.
Of each particle?
For the biggest simulations, about 1,000 solar masses. So something like the LMC, Large Magnetic Cloud, will be resolved with millions of particles. Mm-hmm. But the whole system has 1.5 billion particles. Actually, it's not this one, as I said, this is actually the level 2 resolution, but also there aren't enough pixels in the projector to do justice to the largest simulations. So it's like, you know, there's no way to render this in a way that is much better than the level two already. But it gives an idea of, you know, what's
if you compare, if you could see the baryons and when the disks are forming, what's the time frame for that to be happening compared to the time frame we see here?
What we think is that the baryons basically are accumulating at the center only, okay, on the very tiny region at the center of this and many other objects as well.
And what redshift does that happen at?
That happens all the time. So it's a continuous process by which, you know, as dark matter comes in, brings in some baryons, and those baryons, you know, basically instead of, you know, remain in the outer regions, because they're precipitated, they can lose energy, you know, through, you know, collisions, shock, excitation, energy, you know, photon production, basically. They can go and sink to the center, and they become part of these disks. You know.
But if this had been the Milky Way, when would we expect we'd be able to actually see a disk there?
For the Milky Way, at about redshift of 1 or so, I think that a reasonably, you know, well-defined disk would be. Think of the sun. The sun is part of the disk, and it formed about, you know, redshift 0.5 or so, formed about 5.5 billion years ago. So redshift 0.5, we know that disk, almost like it is today, existed and was fairly well established. So redshift 1 is the guess, and it's not a very bad one. I mean, like, if you're interested, we can show you some images of things that we do follow the baryons, where these disks actually do form, to give you an idea. But that's not part of what I plan to do. Today. But if you're interested, I can certainly, you know, show you some relations back time. Anyway, that's to give you an idea of, you know, what are we talking about.
Thanks.
Is it too much or too little? This is like the too much, too little. It's like the bailouts in the US. Okay, let me go a bit more detail into the simulation. This is just top simulation one particular time. It's a low resolution one, and a couple of things I wanted to show you. This is what happens as you increase the resolution. This is like level 3, level 2, and level 1. And the thing you can see from here, of course, they have more particles. Many of these structures become sharply defined. The other thing I wanted to see is that many of these features actually get reproduced almost identically in the simulations. So think of, you know, the position, for example, and the relative masses of these little substructures. Look at this one, for example. They're all in the same position. They're all in the same position. Okay, flick them back and forth, almost in the same position, almost with the same masses. I'd like to track one by one the substructures, not on the main payload, but one by one the substructures, and check, you know, how each of them has evolved, how each of them has changed as we increase the numerical resolution. That will become important in the end.
Can I ask you, how do you define a substructure?
That's not a trivial question, actually. The simplest or the most robust way, which is not necessarily the way that we do it, okay, because it would take too long, is the centers of the substructure are very easy to find. Now, where does the substructure end? It's unclear. So what you do is actually, what you should do is take the centers of this, define the subset of particles, and then go back in time until that subset of particles becomes part of an isolated system, and see what is the total bound mass of that isolated system, and then follow it forward in time, and see which of those particles stop being part of that system as the substructure, you know, evolves in the potential of the main halo. That is what should be done. Well, we don't do that because, of course, it means tracking back and forth many, many thousands of substructures over many, many times, and it's basically prohibitive. So we develop, you know, sort of simple techniques to try and approximate that method by using only the properties at a particular time. But what you're trying to do is trying to find the maximally self-bound system of particles, so that if you were to grab those, remove everything else, and leave it there, it would remain as a bound system. It won't just, you know, basically disappear. So it's not just a collection of particles that are close together just by chance.
How are the initial conditions set? I mean, where do you start? Because, I mean, where that goes is, as you increase the resolution, are you putting more and more substructures in the initial conditions, or are these developing after, or?
When you are, what you do is what you're trying to do is simulate basically a random process, a Gaussian random field at a particular time. And you know,
punches into the initial condition.
Correct. And no power spectrum. Okay. So the only thing that you need is really the power spectrum. So, and then of course, if you choose your phases and the choice of each phase in Fourier space will give you a particular realization of that random field. So what you do is, if you change the resolution, what you're doing is basically you have, you know, one frequency, which is the highest to which you can actually resolve, which is for the Nyquist frequency or particle grid or equivalent, onto which you build your initial conditions. As you increase the numerical resolution, the Nyquist frequency becomes higher, so you're able to include power on, you know, higher frequencies. So not exactly equivalent, but they're equivalent from the point of view of the power spectrum. And then, of course, you know, as you evolve these things, the whole thing becomes very non-Gaussian. This is what you end up with. But you can see that because of the shape of the power spectrum, just knowing the large-scale modes or large-scale waves is enough to give you this thing. So you can change the numerical resolution by factors of, you know, hundreds, and it's the same object. Sorry, here. That's going the wrong way. You can change, you know, the numerical resolution by factors of hundreds, and still it's the same object with the same substructures, with just more detail if you want to add it onto it. That's it.
So these are different realizations. So you're starting the simulation with whatever the initial conditions are. You let it go, and you're reproducing the same structures.
Correct. So after the Nyquist frequency of the, if the Nyquist sequence, so there will be some frequencies that will resolve in all of the simulations, and some frequencies that won't. After the frequencies are resolved in each of the simulations, phases are exactly the same, and that's how we get the same object. But beyond that, then those frequencies are added, they're independent, and those are added independent for each simulation. So each simulation has the same backbone structure plus detail.
Can you just look through those again, different resolution?
Mm-hmm.
So how much is the resolution different in each of these?
Well, you can see from here, this is 400 cubed, this is the number of particles. And this, the biggest one is 2400 cubed, so it's 24 divided by 4 cubed, whatever the number is, which is
6.
So six cubed in volume, or in mass. Right.
Okay. So you are leaving the long wavelengths fixed.
Correct.
That's common, but the short wavelengths you're adding.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that's a factor of six wavelength. Is it really convincing that if I added a factor of 100, that it would make no difference?
This is where, you know, a true skeptic will never be convinced. You have to wait until they die. So, right? I hope I can convince you that the things that we look at, you know, are probably are insensitive to this.
Identical between these different length scales. So obviously there's some blobs in the lowest resolution one which are not present in the highest. If we go to the lowest resolution one, which is that.
This one? Oops, sorry.
That's the lowest one. So, you know, some of those objects turn out not to be there in the higher resolution.
Some are projections as well, right? So this is a slice, and so we're taking a slice, and then...
But it's the same volume.
It's the same volume, that's right. But, you know, that means you bear in mind that if you look at, for example, the very inner regions, almost nothing is reproduced. That's because they've been many times, right? So a tiny difference in phase, which may be induced just by a tiny difference in the tidal field, will give you, after a couple of orbits, a completely different place in the configuration space. Mm-hmm. So the ones that are really being very well matched in position and in velocity are the ones that have been around not for very long. But that does not mean that we cannot track all of those. Right? We can track the other ones. It's just that we don't care about what position they're at. I mean, we're not going to be able to follow the orbits. You know, the orbits are not going to be identical because, you know, the conditions are not exactly the same. And, you know, just tiny difference in phase will lead to very large deviations. But we still can track what they are, so their properties. Statistically, we can actually compare. So actually, when we do the comparison, we don't look, you know, in position. We actually look in the initial conditions. And we can find in the initial conditions where these clumps were. And those are very well, you know, reproduced in each of the simulations. So a fair amount of, you know, work, that careful work goes into this to make, you know, the things compelling. So it's, if you say if it looks naive, it's not so naive. I mean, it is in a sense, but it's naive but complicated. Straightforward but difficult. Straightforward but technically difficult.
Okay, so another thing I want to show you is this, right? So if you go to a small region where the other there's some substructures, and you blow it up, you can find the substructures contain other substructures inside. Okay, and that's, of course, you know, there's no reason why this shouldn't happen. I think it's what it should happen. So each of the substructures, and each of the substructures should have themselves substructures. So in principle, there is just a problem of, you know, the hierarchy of things here that are going on. And this is one of the problems that has been vexing this field for a long, long time. So for example, for the annihilation signal, what you care is what is the integral of rho squared, basically, the density squared. Because it's very, very highly biased towards the highest density point. So if the substructures are denser than the structure at that location, otherwise they wouldn't be substructures. And therefore, if you're missing substructure, you're missing points of high density. If you're missing points of high density because your numerical resolution is not good enough, how much is that impacting the predictions that you have for example, annihilation signal, something that depends on rho squared. And this is what people call the boost factor that comes from substructure. And there's a number that people just say, oh, well, I'll assume the boost factor is 100, 1,000, 10, 2, whatever. And so this is the kind of things we would like to tie down with this. And unless you have this kind of simulations, you actually cannot do it. In this simulation, the largest one, we actually resolve four different levels of substructure. So we have a halo, a substructure halo. In this instead of substructure, we find another substructure. And instead of substructure, we find even more. Okay? But that can principally go on for a while. It's a funny combination of velocity dispersion and density. So it's a mapping where the hue is either velocity or color, and the density is actually the brightness. So that's why some appear green, some appear. Volker Springle, which is the one who has done many of these things, most of these things, he likes this. And once he likes that, it's unclear what it will ever change. But,
so the green things are not velocity.
Or the other way around. But you know, since they're smaller, I think you're probably correct. Right? So again, the hue is the velocity version, the brightness is the color. And that, you know, maps into funny colors, and when you have a color palette that is not very, that's not very, very good like this one. Well, it's actually very hard to project these things, and you actually make beautiful pictures, then you project them and nothing shows up. So why do you bother is the bottom line. So. Anyway, so this is just give an idea of how this thing converge or not. This is the mass profile. Okay, this is top at the center. And plot the density average over spherical shells as a function of radius. And this is the same halo, is that right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different resolutions, going from 200 cubes now to 2400 cubes. Okay? So that's the number of particles in the dimension conditions. And these are plotted all on top of each other. You can see that down to the level that we trust each of the simulations, then there's almost no difference. This universal profile that I was talking about at the beginning, you can actually predict. I mean, actually, it's just a little formula, a simple formula, an empirical formula. You can actually plot it here. Actually, it's plotted here. It's plot a thin black line that goes under all the points. You cannot see it. It's like like to say that it's like, you know, when Kobe flew and you get this black body and say, oh, we plot a Planckian, but you cannot see it because it's all within the error bar or something. Same thing here, actually. But that's not too surprising if you think of it. These are 4 orders of magnitude radius and 7 orders of magnitude in density. So even if we offer people 2, it still looks quite good. So I mean, a more telling way of looking at this is by taking out the mean trend by multiplying all the densities by R squared, which is, you know, kind of the mean profile. And you can see two things you can see here. If this was just, for example, an isothermal sphere, it was rho proportional power to minus 2, this would be a uniform, you know, horizontal line once you multiply by R squared. And it's not. You can see this is not a power law at all. It's curving all over. Yeah, and it's shallow in the inner regions, shallower than minus 2, and it's actually steeper than isothermal in the other regions. It has a very well-defined shape. It kind of curves over at a particular rate.
And these are, again, the simulation. You can see, actually, the results are actually quite good. You can stuff, for example, seeing now the bumps produced by the individual substructures. You see the bumps actually reproduce from simulation to simulation overall, which tells you that more of the main bumps, actually the main clumps, are actually being reproduced consistently from simulation to simulation. You can plot this in terms of radius, you can plot this also in terms of cumulative mass, enclosed mass. This is basically, if you take the cumulative mass divided by the radius, gives you the secret velocity, or the square of secret velocity at that radius. And this is also what people like to plot, because, you know, it's easier sometimes to compare with observations. So this is the secret velocity function of radius, and again, it goes up and down. It has a very well-defined maximum and a well-defined position for the maximum. And we can actually establish this position, the position maximum and the velocity for, you know, all of the substructures, and the comparisons I'll show in a minute are actually quite good. So let me speed up a little bit here. Try to convince you first that the structure of this cusp, we actually learned a bit about the structure of the cusp, and we can actually tell that it's much shallower than this minus 1.5 value. And this is the logarithm of the density profile function of radius. You can see, you know, except for the bumps, in the inner region, actually very well behaved. And it's at the innermost point that we trust is of the order of minus 1. It's much shallower than minus 1.5. So that tells us right away that, for example, a process like annihilation, like with scales like R square, will not be dominated by a central region. Most of the photons will come from a sizable region across the sky, for example, in the case of the Milky Way. That's the center is, we find it as the position of the most bound particle, or the position that where the potential energy is minimum, which actually is not, it's not, they're not exactly the same. But it's very well defined. It's really not a problem. We can actually, you know, find it consistently from simulation in ways that are not difficult.
So you literally sum up the potential energy of that particle with all the other particles?
With all the other particles. All within the pair. So, and you find the minimum of the potential energy, which is very, very close to the minimum of the most bound particle, but it's also very close to the highest density as well. So you have several ways to check. None of the things that I'm going to say, all the details change, but none of the things I'm going to say, the conclusions will depend on exactly how that is done. It's fairly well defined procedure. Okay, so this cusp, you know, as I say, is shallow. That interesting thing that something like put here for James to see, it relates a paper that wrote a while ago now, while he was a graduate student, is the fact that the density you see seems to have this very, you know, changing curving power law, curving profile, which is basically not a power law. If you take now another dynamical measure, instead of the density, take the density and divide by the velocity dispersion cube. In other words, construct a number that has the dimensions of phase space density, then this actually is almost an exact power law of radius. So there's something in this universal profile that we're talking about that really is very simple once you choose the right coordinates here. This is basically just the kinetic energy of a particular shell, of all the parts in a particular shell. So take the basic mass in a shell divided by the kinetic energy to the right power to make it into a cube. And this is an exact part. The other thing that's interesting is that the slope here is actually not a fit. This is what you get just from the simplest solution to this kind of problem they can do, which is take an Einstein the city universe, put a point mass, an extra point mass, so an amplitude Einstein the city universe, put a point mass, and see how shells accumulate. Then you can work out, you know, a sub-similar solution, which tells you what is the slope. It is exactly the same slope. You see, the way in which you form these halos have nothing to do with, you know, piling one shell after the other and radial motions, but it's still some of this are actually reproduced, you know, almost uncannily. So this is the kind of things that we still working on. So let me now try to move quickly now to a bit more of dark matter detection and annihilation. This is the density probability, density function. In other words, if you are close to the center of the halo, as close as the sun is, how clumpy is the halo? Okay. And which goes back to this question of, you know, for example, there's structures. Do these hierarchical structures of substructures embedded in substructures end at some point, or does it go all the way as a fractal to, and we can be, for example, unlucky enough that the Earth is very close to this massive, you know, massive in terms of the Earth, a very dense magmatic glob that is just passing through the Earth or not? So can we be in a total vacuum where there's absolutely no dark matter, just where we are by chance? So what it, and that is the, so in other words, how clumpy is this? So we can do this, and we can actually go to the simulation, find the location of this clump about the sun, and then go around and ask, you know, how, what is the probability density function? In other words, how much is density changing as I move around on this location that's of comparable radius to the sun? And this is what you see, you know, relative to the mean density, we're only interested in the scatter, basically. This is what you find. You find something that's actually reasonably broad, and it has these, you know, bumps and clumps on the other parts. I say, oh, aha, I know, this is the scatter that I see. Actually, this is not the scatter that I see. This is just Poisson, right? We have to do this estimate somehow. And so this is actually just the Poisson noise that comes from using a particular number for the estimator. You can change the number of estimator, of course, the numbers will change. But in other words, the density that we have, the halo, is much smoother than this. We can think of the halo then as a very, very smooth component with some, you know, perturbers over here, which are very unlikely. Okay? So to first order this I can work out the through numbers here. This all published actually in a paper by Mark Fogelsberger. And you can convince yourself that the halo, to all practical purposes, once you're close enough to the center, like the sun is very basically a very smooth component. There is no hierarchy of substructures that never ends. Okay. The halo basically has been phase mixed to almost, you know, a very, very good degree. Correct. This is just a standard version. Well, this is, you'll actually need also the positions of the subhalos to be exactly in the same place. Right? So it's unlikely that this will converge for reasons that we talked, and we've so close to the center that the crossing times are very short. Right? These halos that survive here have crossing times which allow them to go through hundreds of orbits. So it's very unlikely we find, you know, an exact correspondence in configuration space. So we're not worried about this. We're just worried about the probability density function has to be in similar shape. And you can actually see that the two highest resolution ones actually resemble each other fairly good, out to almost 10 rho mean. So it's actually quite encouraging. Maybe let's look at the velocities as well. Just show you the plot. If there was a Gaussian, the velocity distribution on a particular point, then the Gaussian would be this. You can actually see there are all these bumps. These bumps are actually reproducible from simulation to simulation. The velocity of particles going through a particular point in space at the location of the sun. Okay, so this is the modulus of the velocity. Okay, so if this was a Gaussian, this is what you'd have, and it's not. And these little bumps, you can see, you can actually track them. These are reproducible. Simulation simulation can actually, from resolution to resolution, actually find exactly the same bumps. And these are caused not by clumps, but this is structured in phase space. It's basically wraps of disrupted objects. When you're at a particular point, the particles that contribute to the density are basically parts that were disrupted. But when they get disrupted, they get mixed quickly in configuration, but they actually get much less easily mixed in phase space. And this is just one projection of that phase space. So if you actually track, if you can, for example, measure a bump like this one, or a bump like this one, you can actually infer where the particles that you see today in the dark matter came from. Did it come from a big object, small object? When was it, accreted, et cetera? So there's lots of interesting things one can look at here. Let me end rather quickly, I'd say, talking about annihilation. It's a paper we wrote last year, appeared in November. Actually, I think the same week that Obama was elected in Nature. So not a coincidence, but... So the basic idea here is that you have, if the dark matter, if nature cooperates, and dark matter is really a matter particle, then it will self-annihilate when it gets close enough. If you go through the predictions, then the only thing that you care to predict, you know, how much luminosity or how many photons will come out of it, depend on only two things. One, the cross-section, actually the average of sigma v, not even sigma or v, the average sigma v, and the square of the density. I have to integrate that over all the whole volume. So this is basically the particle physics problem, and this is where we can give a good suggestions. So, and as I was saying before, you need to be able to resolve this regions of high density because your signal will be dominated by this region, and that's where the problem has been. So, and over the years, you know, there are some bunch of myths I believe or we think have been accumulating about you know how to detect this annihilation signal. For example. We go through some papers that say that the halo dark matter is mostly in small clumps. All the, because hierarchy goes down and down and down all the way to the small clump, the smallest clump you can form for your particular dark matter model. For the neutralino candidate, for example, would be Earth mass objects. So, for example, it would be all in Earth mass clumps that are just appear to you because you cannot resolve them as a very smooth object. That's one. The other one is that these small clumps should dominate the dark matter signal because they're so dense. If there's one just close to you, it will dominate the signal rather than the signal coming from, you know, an average over the whole sky, or the whole halo. The other thing is that the dwarf spheroidals, you know, the dark matter dominated objects that are orbiting around the halo are the ones that will dominate. And this is not a version of the same. And the other one is that this idea of the boost factors, you know, how is the substructure contributes to the detectability of this annihilation signal. So let me talk very briefly about them, and they're convinced we can actually make progress. This is the mass function substructures. And this is, again, a convergence study. Actually, we think we know fairly well, down to you know reasonable levels, what is the mass function substructures. And so we actually can predict you know what will be the contribution by extrapolating this power law. And again, there will be some extrapolation needed, but I think we actually can do it fairly well. It's shallow minus two, so all the mass is in the few most massive objects, but all the signal for annihilation will come actually from the smallest ones. Okay. This is another thing that's important. So how are they distributed? How are the substructure halos distributed across the halo? Okay. So in other words, I take a very small little substructure halo, I count them, all of them, and see how they're distributed and compare them with ones that are 10 times more massive or 100 times more massive. And the answer is that, surprisingly, they're distributed almost in the same way. Beyond a certain mass, the distribution of dark matter substructures within the halo seems to be independent of mass. And it's not an totally intuitive result, but we believe it is correct in the sense that, you know, once you have a halo 10 to the 12 solar masses like the Milky Way, it doesn't matter if you're now your substructure halo is 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 8. You're so much smaller in mass than the main object that you're just a test particle. So all that you, it's irrelevant. The mass becomes an irrelevant point, and therefore the distribution is all the same. This will become important in a minute. You say, well, how much am I missing? Okay. Actually, you can do that by just taking these mass functions that I showed you before and extrapolating to whatever masses you want. And extrapolate, for example, take this, extrapolate with this power law at the location of the sun, extrapolate down to 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 12 solar masses. And if that power law is correct, then you predict that, I don't know, 1% of the mass of the halo is in substructures in the vicinity of the sun. Okay. Actually, within 400 kiloparsecs now, actually, this is not the sun, this is less than 100 kiloparsecs. With closer to the sun, it's even a lot less than this. It's like 10 to the minus 4, which is the number I was quoting you before. Okay. There's 1% within 100 kiloparsecs. So basically, even if we're missing something, and you extrapolate all the way down to the free streaming scale of the power spectrum, you still, substructures cannot contribute, you know, a lot of the mass. Substructures, although they're very interesting and very relevant, they're not very massive. Okay. So it's called annihilation. For annihilation, then, will, because we don't resolve all the substructures, we need to make some fine assumptions. One is that we know what the mass profile of these halos is, and we'll make use of this, you know, universality. Okay. If that universality is correct, then all we need to know is what are the scales of each halo. In other words, what is, for example, its mass and radius, or expressed in terms of, you know, circular velocity, what is its maximum circular velocity, you know, the peak in the circular velocity curve that I showed you, and what is the location of that peak. If you go through this, the integral of rho squared over volume will give you something that scales like fourth power Vmax divided by Rmax. Now, of course, the flux you'll see will depend on how far away it is. Okay, so we'll go like, it'll appear 1 over d squared, or d is the distance to your substructure. And then if you actually now think that these are not the dominant source, but actually they're in superposed on top, you know, a uniform bright background, then the signal to noise of a particular object will depend on how big it is in the sky, as a, also, and in the same way as the flux. And therefore, the signal to noise will actually scale in a slightly different way, with scale Vmax over Rmax squared times the distance. And this is what will give you the detectability of this object. Okay, so I can actually do it very quickly. What is the detectability, for example, of the object you know exists? Okay, and you can compare how detectable is, for example, the large imaginary cloud, which appears as these little objects in the micro, in the infrared background. You can see how those would appear in the annihilation signal. And the signal to noise of the Milky Way, or the main halo now, compared to LMC, would be 100 times bigger. So this will be one of the main things you want to remember. If you, and this is the one that's probably the most detectable of them. And the main message you want to get out of this is that if you don't detect the Milky Way halo, don't detect the main halo in the direction of the galactic center and its surroundings, it's unlikely you'll believe any detections of any substructures. And this is actually a different conclusion than many previous papers, so it's interesting to say it that way. So, in order to do this, you know, in the proper way, as I said, we need extrapolations, which I hope I convince you that are guided by these convergence studies, by these things that we know. But what we'll need is basically what's the mass function and how they distribute across the sky. And the last thing we need is to see these boosts. You know, how is the substructure that we don't resolve? And what we learn from the simulation as well here is that this substructure is broken. It's broken by tidal interactions. In other words, you get a substructure that is a replica, for example. I'll skip for a bunch of things here just to give you the final point. If the substructure is just a replica of itself, in other words, imagine you have a halo that has four halos inside, that each one has four halos inside. When it's outside, it might be exact replica of this one. But when it's inside, it gets truncated. All the subhalos that are outside the tidal radius are lost. And they just leave that particular system and contribute to the main halo. So therefore, you need to evaluate what is the how many subhalos are retained by these ones. And it turns out that if you go through now the calculations in detail, which I'm skipping, you can convince yourself that just a simple treatment of just a tidal field gives you a good order of magnitude for that problem. And with that, then you can actually produce, you know, annihilation maps, for example, and all the rest. So, sorry about this one, it took me way too long on the other things, but this is what you end up producing. This is the main, this is the shape of, or the appearance of the main smooth halo of the Milky Way in gamma rays. This is what this emission from unresolved halos, so from resolved halos, these are halos you actually see in the simulation. This is the things that we don't see, they're unresolved. The reason why it appears as a uniform background is because they're unresolved, they're very small, they're not resolved by, for example, Fermi or glass, for which we did these predictions, and they're also very far away. They're all in the outskirts of the halo, so, and we're very close to the center. So they appear to us as just a uniform background. And this is all of it, you know, put together. And just, you know, to drive the point that if you don't detect this, it is unlikely to believe one of these detections over here. Okay. So
difference in intensity from
this is log intensity, and this actually this have been all
log,
yeah, from 10. 2 log, yeah, from 2 to -0.5.
So it's right, 300.
Right. So it's the main, you know, conclusions we want to leave here is that this myths that I talked about, I think we can, you know, more or less convincingly rule out, and that it is, you know, it just gives you a good blueprint as to how you're going to search for this signal. And the signal is expected to be exceedingly weak, and therefore how to pull out the signal, you know, once you have really a good map of gamma rays over the whole sky, how you pull out the signal is important. So this gives you, for example, a way in which you can actually design a filter look at a signal. Once you, if you have a good filter, you know, you can actually convince yourself that there is a detection or not. So, you know, we're hoping that people who are doing this analysis, which are was very clever, will, you know, heed our advice and use this kind of predictions in order to interpret the data. So I think I'll stop here. Sorry for being a bit too long.
They talked about the lumps, right? But so you also mentioned earlier in the talk that there are these streams which are still dense in phase space, even if they've been washed out in normal space. Does that make any difference to these calculations, consideration?
For annihilation, I mean?
Yeah.
No. They're very low density in density space, and that's all you care. You care how...
You just care about close in velocity doesn't give you any extra.
No, it doesn't matter. It turns out that that's something actually has been looked at by applied physicists, and it turns out that because most of these models, the only annihilations, the S wave annihilation basically dominates over any other process by huge amounts. I'm talking about things that I don't know very well myself. And the only thing you care is what is the average sigma v. So the velocity correction basically are irrelevant for this. But you have to take my word for it. Well, not my word for many other people who have done calculations carefully.
The low velocity, the cross section is always goes up when I'm moving. Sort of think of that as particles in a box, whose the Broglie wavelengths just completely encompass each other. And so the cross section is independent. The final rate is independent. It's independent. The final rate is independent of velocity.
Okay.
At low velocity. So everything here is moving so slow that it effectively all overlaps.
Right.
So sigma v is cross section is actually a bad notion. Okay. Velocity. It's just the rate of wave function.
So one of the v cancels the v.
Exactly.
Right. This is not collisions in the way that you think of, you know, that you know you have your parameter and you know you work it out.
It's just
the
like,
velocity
doesn't help. So, sort of technical question. When you go to higher resolution simulations, what do you do with the smoothing length? Because all these simulations have a smoothing length. Do you leave it and a time step and all that? Do you leave all those?
No, all those things.
Small quantities fixed?
No. All those things adapt to the resolution that you have in the simulation. So, if you have more and more particles,
right.
Result if I, small. The smoothing length is always scaled with the length scale of the grid, the original grid, for example. So if you put more particles,
you make it fixed in grid units. You leave the smoothness.
It's fixed in commoving coordinates.
What is it?
No.
So your simulations differ on the small scales.
Yes.
I mean that's scary.
Well, it's scary for some things, it's not scary for others. I mean, if you find something that depends on the smoothing length, then you're not going to be needed. In that sense, it is scary. But we've you know been doing this for decades now.
Yeah.
So I think you know fairly well, there's a body of evidence that I can, you know, can discuss with a bunch of the reference that can show you that once you're in the right regime, you can change this smoothing length by factors of 100. Thousand, nothing changes. Right? Not the results that I'm talking about changes. The mass profiles, the numbers of structures, all those things are exactly the same. So, again, this is the true skepticism, not proof.
Yeah.
But it does make you get to the sleep at night. Right?
Is there a scale on which baryonic factors can become relevant?
That's a good question. I mean, these predictions are made only. Assuming that there are no variants, right? So clearly there are variants, and in the Negroid in particular, they're simply fairly important. So, and those need to be taken into account to, you know, for example, if you want to design this optical filter that I was talking about. Now, how to do that is still unclear, right? What seems to be the short answer I can give you is that the additional variance, the cooling and you know, the assembly of the galaxy can only lead to a dark matter halo that is denser in almost every radius than what this simulation will give you.
So from that point of view, these are basically lower limits on what you'd expect. It may change the shape of the dark matter field also near the center, so I might change the filter. And those things probably need to be taken into account when you want to analyze the data. But as you can see from here, now this is the whole sky. Sorry. This is so big that we think that those effects would probably be important on the black regions. Still, you won't be able to detect, you know, a fairly extended background of, well, not background, fairly extended source of dark matter, of gamma ray signals, that is more or less round and extends out to 10 degrees. There's nothing in the galaxy that looks like that. So if you can find that, then you're reasonably, even if you don't get the matching correctly, if you can find that, then I think you're in good shape. But the answer is a good one, and the question is a good one. We actually don't know exactly. We know the zeroth order, but not the details.
Other questions?
Oh, I'm sorry, but there's two. But I would like, in these universal arrows with density distributions, always there is a center of localized matter in the center, or not?
You mean like a black hole or something? So something much denser? No, there's nothing obvious there. I mean, so of course, we don't resolve that region, so we don't know for sure. But there's nothing that we, in the series that we have, that leads us to expect that there will be something, you know, a very abrupt change in the properties that we have. What we think is that what's happening is that this slowly curving slope actually just keeps on going all the way to the center. And all these numbers that I've shown you here have assumed that. You know.
You mean that the center is not singular? It may be not singular.
It cannot be singular. I mean, I'm saying cusp is much denser than anything you care about in astronomical terms. But of course, I mean, it won't be singular. Cold dark matter is cold, but it's not freezing. Right? So, so it has some velocity dispersion that comes, you know, from, you know, whatever it is that the candidate is, and that at some point, you know, will make it have a finite phase space, and therefore will, you know, put an end to this cuspiness. But it's on scales that are so much smaller than this ones that, for all practical purposes, will treat it as a divergent. And so there's so little mass in that region that it doesn't change any of these numbers.
Other questions? Okay, thank you. If the direct detection of the dark matter doesn't work out, are there ways, astrophysical observations that you can do that would confirm this particular, paradigm, as it were? Like, are there things you could see observationally that would tell you that, that all of this is...
That does not rely on annihilation, I mean. Mm-hmm. I think the most interesting things from that point of view are the substructures. I mean, we can make predictions of numbers of substructures, there's internal structures as well, and those, you know, as more and more of the substructures are discovered, it's likely we'll be able to use those to constrain them. So for example, you know, this before this new, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but no, the number of satellites in the Milky Way has doubled over the past, you know, 5 years or so. People used to think, oh, it's the LMC, SMC, and 10 more. Now there are dozens of them. Mm-hmm. I won't even know that people haven't found them before just because they're very found. But they have very hard to find. They're very faint, they're very sort of low surface brightness. You need really, you know, dedicated algorithms working on very large scales of the sky, on images very, you know, unique photometry, very, you know, stable photometry, and those have only been available lately. And there are actually many new projects that are trying to push the boundary a bit more. Pan-STARRS, you know, many other things are actually geared to doing that. And before that, you know, people thought that the census was complete. We knew all the satellites on the Milky Way, and you could have gone to, you know, hundreds of conferences where people said that. But, you know, you do the simulation, say, well, there are, you know, how many are in this halo there? In this halo here, we have 500,000 substructures. Right? Compared to 10 or 12 satellites that were known then, we have actually resolved 500,000. So the idea that there has to be more there than what we had seen was basically, you know, in these models before. And so my hope is that, you know, one can use that. I mean, the mapping is not going to be one-to-one, it will depend on, you know, which of these subhalos are the ones that have stars or not, but I believe that, you know, with more work, there will be a way of making the connection and, you know, convince yourself whether this is really, you know, consistent with what people call.
Do you think stars will form in these halos?
No, well, we know that they form some. But,
some of the very small ones.
Some of the very small ones, yeah.
Because they've been observed?
Yes. Well,
how small is
it? Okay. Well, not this small. Not that small.
Not that small.
Not that small. No.
What, 10 to the 7 or something like that?
Well, people think that depends what you're talking about, the mass, the time they form, the mass they have today. Well, you can only measure the mass inside the luminous radius, right? So you're likely measuring only the mass in the region where you can see the stars, right? So mass can be much bigger. Mm-hmm. And those are 10 to the 8 or so. There. So we're on this one. It's a long way below. Maybe these things do exist. They do form stars, but if you're only from one star, how are you going to tell? So it's. But, you know, if people have thought that maybe there are ways of, you know, trying to see whether these things, which are dark, basically exist or not. You know, the interaction with the disk, you know, the creation and sustain of star alarms, and you get quickly exotic astronomy here going on, and you develop a bit less, and you have a lot less intuition. But go back to your question. I think there are, you know, I think the substructure in the Milky Way is one of the most exciting things that has developed in the past for 5 years or so.
Yes.
In this case, the gamma rays that you plotted is based on particular model from particle physics, or it comes from the annihilation of dark matter.
Correct. Everything we've done, though, does not assume any particular model for reflection gamma rays. So we've all done, you know, things relative to each other. Like, you know, for example, if you weigh what is the importance of the substructure, we compare the substructure to the main halo itself. Right. So, in other words, the unknown particle physics, these sigma v's and things, and the actual efficiency of that, of the creation of the gamma rays from that, all cancels out. So we know the halo has to be a lot more important than the other ones. But how important the halo is in itself, and how many gamma rays come from this halo, will depend on the particle physics. I mean, maybe that's what I said, zero. Because, you know, if the hormone doesn't annihilate, there will be no gamma rays. That'd be depressing, but, you know, that's definitely a possibility. So we don't know. That's why it's always better, once you found something, it's always easier to explain that if you don't find anything, explain why you didn't.
Differential, though, but there's like 1.9, or is it the integral?
This is the differential. So the integral for n minus 2, Sheldon, n squared, n minus 2 should be here.
Right.
Sorry, an error here.
N minus 2
is the divergent one, the logarithmic divergence, right, or in mass. If it's n minus 2, there's equal mass in each decade.
Roughly is equal.
It's roughly, yeah, that's why it's hard, right? So you have to really trust that we've done this properly. But some token, you can actually assume that this is, you know, minus 2. And it doesn't really change much. It's logarithmic. You need to really push logarithm a lot to get something out of it. Right? So that's why it's called a logarithm. So you see, this is this. Well, it's minus 2, is it right? So look at this. And it does this divergence. But still, you're anchored here. You can only go 10 decades. You get, yeah, factor 2. Logarithm is really logarithm. It's slow.
Okay, well, let's thank Julio again.